You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is Olivia Nuzzi, the Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. Nuzzi initially gained fame after writing about her experiences as an intern on Anthony Weiner's doomed mayoral campaign, and then went to work at the Daily Beast. Since joining New York Magazine, she has written extensively about the Trump White House. Her profile of Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski and their fraught relationship with President Trump is currently the magazine's cover story. She's also written about other White House personalities, including Kellyanne Conway, Steve Bannon, and Reince Priebus. Olivia Nuzzi joins me now by phone, a special by phone appearance. How are you, Olivia?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. We've had some trouble recording this, which I should tell our audience, because you are currently outside the White House. Is that correct?
I am. I'm outside the, I guess technically the West Wing. So if you hear any noise, it's like Secret Service walking by and slamming doors. Because there's really no space in the White House to make any kind of phone calls, and there's no cell service in the lower press area, which is where all the reporters do their work, which is problematic, as you could imagine.
I can't imagine. So let me ask you this, because we're recording this Thursday afternoon. And my question for you is, can you just kind of go through your day on a day like today where you've been at the White House, sort of how it starts and how it ends and what's in between?
Well, I was up really late because Anthony Scaramucci, the new communications director, was basically waging war against the current White House chief of staff. And I was trying to sort of figure out exactly what was happening there and trying to talk to him. And so I got a bit of a late start today. And basically, you know, I came here, I went to the briefing, and now I'm just going to hang around here and try and do some interviews and figure out, you know, what exactly is going on. But the problem is that it changes so rapidly, you know, so whatever is true today on Thursday may not be true tomorrow, may not be true on Monday. I mean, it's likely that it won't be true anymore.
So let me ask you, what's it like hanging around the White House sort of before and after the briefings? What are your interactions like with people in the White House staff and the White House press office? Because obviously the picture we see on television is very contentious and fraught.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I hear people criticize Sarah Huckabee Sanders quite a lot for being rude or dismissive during the briefing. And I've never found her to come across that way. I think she just has kind of a dry sense of humor, which I appreciate. But I guess it doesn't translate very well on camera or something. But, you know, the general vibe this week, at least, I think it's pretty different than it has been with Anthony Scaramucci here. Sean Spicer is still here, which is pretty awkward. He's still roaming around and he's still in his office part of the time. So it's sort of, you know, there's sort of like an awkwardness at the staff level in the upper press area, which is behind the briefing lectern. There's this little blue door that slides open, and you can go back there as a member of the press and sort of wait outside of the offices of the communications department staff and, you know, try and get comment or try and sit down for an interview or whatever. And this week it just felt a little bit different. And I don't know if Spicer was sort of the reason why everything had felt very tense here in the past, but it has felt, you know, sort of very much like a new era in terms of White House communications, even though Anthony Scaramucci is not exactly nailing it in his first 2 days on the job or first 3 days.
Well, then two questions. One, what was your relationship like with Spicer? And two, how has that atmosphere changed to the extent that you can speculate on this next phase?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I am in the briefing oftentimes, but I'm not here every day, and I'm not a part of, like, the press pool, right? So it's not like I'm someone who is always raising my hand and in his face and trying to get him to respond to me on camera. But we have had a pretty cordial relationship. I mean, he's gotten mad at me a couple of times. I've received a few angry phone calls from him, but generally speaking, it's pretty cordial. I would never say that he's like particularly helpful to me, because nobody in this White House is particularly helpful, because they either don't know what the truth is or they can't tell you the truth. But you know, he was fine to me. I don't have sort of the negative feelings that some reporters seem to have when it comes to Sean Spicer. But it's just different. It just feels more relaxed this week, and maybe it's because everything is in such disarray and there's so much chaos, and it's the mooch, as we're unfortunately calling him.
Not on this podcast, we're not. Not on this podcast.
It's a very unfortunate nickname, and I'm pretty mad about it. But I think it's bad for the Italians more broadly. But anyway, he has a very, very different style than Sean Spicer had. And, you know, part of what I'm hearing when I talk to people who are close to the president and who are close to Scaramucci is that that's pretty much the whole gist of why he was brought on. It's because he and Trump viscerally understand each other. People have noted they have a lot of the same mannerisms, even the same body language. He understands Trump in a way that Sean Spicer just couldn't. He just never quite got the whole Trump phenomenon, just on a sort of spiritual level. And I guess that is sort of the hope, is that having someone like Scaramucci around is going to make Trump happier, make him feel more at home.
You said something interesting, which is you said that people in the White House either can't tell you the truth or don't know the truth. So I guess the obvious follow-up to that is then, how anxious are you when you're writing stories that require quotes either on the record or anonymously from White House sources? And how do you balance that tension, given that this is obviously not a normal White House in terms of telling the truth?
I think that you can't look at them as sort of people who are going to provide you with information. You have to look at them as subjects. So even if it's on background, it's still coming from the White House, and the White House is still the subject, if that makes sense. So it's like, I think of it less in terms of, well, you know, I need an answer to this question. I have to contact the White House, or I have to contact a senior official or the White House press office. And I look at it more as like, you know, it's an interesting part of the story, it's color, to figure out what the White House is trying to tell you, or, you know, what White House staffers are saying amongst themselves.
So the meta story, in a way, is the story. It's like what message they're trying to get across is in itself interesting, regardless of what else may be underlying it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing about this White House, and the thing about Trump in general, you know, I covered him during the campaign as well, is that everyone in his orbit is always trying to fuck someone else. And once you determine who it is that they're trying to fuck over, it's sort of easier to process what they say. You know, you can figure out where these allegiances lie at the moment. And although they're ever shifting, it's pretty easy to figure out, you know, who's on which team. And there are all these different factions within the White House. I think Maggie Haberman referred to it recently in that David Remnick interview as being like actual gangs. And so, you know, that's sort of how I look at it, just sort of, you know, their quotes are interesting insight into what the general vibe is in the White House, more than it's about getting information from them.
So let me ask you that, the idea of gangs, is there any sense of actual camaraderie among different factions in the White House? Or is it sort of, I mean, is there any sense among even groups of people, if not the whole White House, that we're in this together to, you know, together make good policies that are going to make America better, and we feel this sense of, you know, whatever, team spirit? Or is that just naive, and basically even with a certain amount of different gangs, there's absolutely none of that?
If that exists, I haven't seen it. I mean, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. Other reporters may have seen it, but I just haven't. It's more like everyone seems to be out for themselves, and sometimes people's interests will align, and then they will be aligned with one another. I mean, I think this has happened with Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus. Initially, they hated each other, and they did an interview with me very early on in the administration to try and convince me that they were in love with each other and that they were best friends. And they put on this whole show about how they were giving each other back massages and they were best friends and they were bonding. And they would go to sleep, fall asleep texting each other at night. And they did that with a number of reporters. And I think, you know, as time has gone on, they found that they have to be on each other's side oftentimes because, you know, people in the White House are basically trying to shiv each other.
Maggie Haberman, who you mentioned, who's the White House correspondent for The New York Times, said something to me, which is that she thought that people in the White House talked to her as a form of therapy, sort of a reality check, mm-hmm. because they viewed reporters, even despite what the rhetoric may be, as offering a certain amount of truth-telling about what was actually going on. Is that something that you feel that you get when you talk to people in the White House?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Oftentimes, with all sorts of different officials, they will ask you for your assessment of a given situation or your assessment of them or your assessment of, you know, what their relationship with another official looks like. And I certainly have never experienced that before. I granted, I did not cover, you know, the Obama administration. So I can't really speak to how different that is, but most reporters seem to be in agreement that, you know, this is something. The vibe here is it's very different than we've seen in the past. But yeah, I mean, they will ask you just, you know, well, do you think that, how do you think this looked? Or do you think I'm qualified for this job? You know, what do you think it looks like? And I think it's like you're in a bubble when you work here. And you're in a bubble working for Trump more broadly. And it's a way for them to kind of get a reality check or just kind of learn how it looks on the outside. And Trump does this a lot, too. I mean, one of Trump's most consistent traits is that he's always polling everyone around him to figure out what they think before he decides anything. He did this famously at Mar-a-Lago, I believe, on Thanksgiving, where he was asking random party guests who he should pick as Secretary of State. And so I think maybe it's a function of being around Trump. You just start to do kind of the same thing, where you're constantly asking people for their assessment.
Leadership
also,
starts at the top.
You know, you become... Yeah, you know, the fish, what is it, the fish rots from the head.
That's probably more apt, yeah.
And so I think it's, you know, probably a little bit of you become Trump-like when you are around Trump for a very long time, but also I think a lot of people here are aware that it looks very different from the outside.
You've written about...
Whether or not they agree,
right.
It's a different story, but they are curious at the very least of how it looks.
You've written about some of the women in Trump's orbit, for example, Kellyanne Conway and Hope Hicks, who I don't know exactly what her official title is now. But and I was just curious because, you know, obviously issues of Trump and women are fraught, again, not to sound euphemistic here. And I was wondering what you think it's like to be a woman working in this White House and specifically what you think the women who do click with Trump, what it is they're doing or are forced to do to kind of play in this very male, very, again, I can only think of euphemisms, environment.
Yeah, I mean, I profile a number of the women in his orbit. It's kind of been a recurring theme throughout my campaign coverage and now my White House coverage. You know, I profiled Hope Hicks, Marla Maples. The only interview she gave during the election was to me. Kellyanne Conway, obviously. You know, they're very fascinating to me because he's someone who women don't like broadly, and who obviously has said all sorts of horrific things about women, whether it's about their looks or you know, their intellect, or he's, you know, assessing their mental health. He likes to call women crazy a lot. I think basically, you know, to survive here as a woman, you just have to kind of be able to let things roll off of you in a way that I always think about the first time that I interviewed Trump in person. You know, I went to Trump Tower and Hope Hicks let me into the office and she seemed very nervous because I was profiling her. And she said to him, "Oh, well, this is Olivia. She's very young." And I just sort of looked at her like, why would that be your intro for me? And he looked me up and down and he was like, very young and very beautiful. And I always think like, you know, if that were a job interview, I would have run out of there. I would never have wanted to work in that place. But he was, you know, about to be the Republican nominee at that point, and now he's the president. and I, you know, have to cover him all the time. But I always just think, like, you know, if someone had said that to me, if I was going in for an interview at New York Magazine, and that's how I was greeted by the guy in charge, I never would have accepted the job. But I think you just have to kind of look at Trump as being very different, as being almost like an alien figure in order to be able to deal with what it's like to work here. You just can't really assess him by normal human standards.
And you think that's what the women in his orbit do?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, no matter what he says, and granted, like, I think there's been a lot of, like, wink, wink kind of coverage of Hope Hicks, who's the director of, I believe, Strategic Communications, and arguably, you know, one of the most powerful people here. She really is a gatekeeper. She controls access.
And is very, very young as well. Not as young as you, who you told me before.
They're 28.
Yeah, who you told me before the interview are 24. But yes, go on.
You asked. But yes, and at least when it comes to her, I mean, he really does seem to regard her as a daughter. And granted, he said some very creepy things about his own daughter.
I was about to say.
But, you know, he does seem to really think of his staff here like family. And I think that's why it's been difficult for him to let people go, even when he has, you know, reason to fire them.
So let's just step back for a second before I just ask you a couple more questions about Trump, which is how did you, for people who don't know, how did you get into journalism?
Well, when I was a senior in high school, sorry, there's security walking past me here. When I was a senior in high school, I worked for an alt-weekly in New Jersey, where I'm from, called the Tri-City News. And I wrote political columns for them. And I freelanced for a little bit, and I, when I was in college, I was at Fordham University very briefly. I started freelancing in a more meaningful way, and in that time, I signed up to be Anthony Weiner's intern for his mayoral campaign, and with the thought that, you know, at the very least, I would, you know, be able to see a very high pressure communications operation at work, or you know, if things didn't go particularly well, I would be able to write about it one day. And things did not go particularly well, and so I wrote about it, and it turned into, you know, kind of an insane tabloid story. And then after that, you know, I just continued to write, and I ended up dropping out of college to join the Daily Beast full time.
When you think about how the Anthony Weiner story was covered in the media and the amount of attention it was given, and obviously you as you said wrote a piece about it. When you look back, what do you think of that? And was it overboard?
Was it overboard, the coverage of Anthony Weiner in general?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it was a completely bizarre story, and I mean, obviously it was covered to death, and I'm sure there were more important things that should have been driving the news cycle. But no, absolutely not. I think it was an insane, you know, American politics story. And now, like, a great tragedy when you think about how it all unfurled. And I, you know, I said this recently, but it's like those last 2 years in American politics are sort of like the second half of Goodfellas, when everything just starts sort of hitting the fan. And it's like the way that everything has sort of concluded here, with Donald Trump as president, Anthony Weiner is like a sex offender. It's just, no one could have guessed these things, maybe the Anthony Weiner thing, but it seems unlikely people would have guessed this, you know, just a couple of years ago. But no, it was very strange. But I, you know, the Weiner thing, because I got my start as a subject, I think I kind of view my own subjects very differently, because I know what it's like to be written about in a way that has no connection to who I am or who I feel like I am. So it was actually, you know, as uncomfortable as it was to be like on the cover of a tabloid when I was like 20, it still, I think it was very useful in that I think I'm more empathetic to people in the press, or more, I understand, you know, kind of the conflict that you feel internally if you are someone who's written about.
Why were you on the cover of a tabloid?
Because I wrote about Anthony Weiner, and they decided to put my face on the cover of the Daily News.
Was that experience of interning for Weiner different than for the time you were there, different than people might think in any way? Was there something about the experience itself that stuck out to you, aside from all the craziness going on, being involved in politics?
No, I mean,
at that level?
I was there for like a month. You know, I was like there for barely a month. I was in college. I was a terrible intern. You know, I didn't do anything I was supposed to do. And then I wrote about it. So I couldn't have been like a less helpful intern as far as those things go. But no, it wasn't. I mean, I don't think it was any different than people assumed it was. And, you know, it was just it was an interesting experience to kind of get caught up in that, however peripherally.
You've now been covering Trump for a couple of years, I guess, from his campaign, which was started a little more than 2 years ago. Have you noticed any changes in him as a person?
No, that's the thing. It's like I just profiled Jeff Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski for New York Magazine.
I mentioned that in my intro, so you don't even need to hype it.
Yeah, but, you know, they their whole idea that they want people to believe that Donald Trump is in any way different than he was. It's absurd. I mean, this is a man who, I think he was in the second grade when he gave his music teacher a black eye because, quote, I didn't think he knew anything about music. You know, like the idea that he's any different than he's ever been is so silly to me. I think he's probably lonelier than he was when he was in Trump Tower. I think maybe he's, you know, unhappier. Maybe he's a little bit more paranoid than he was. But I don't think fundamentally he's any different as a human being than he's ever been.
You mentioned lonely. To what degree are his family part of the sort of daily scene at the White House? I mean, given that Jared and Ivanka play roles in the administration, and Jared clearly a very important role, they're very, you know, they're not familiar in a certain way, the way Reince Priebus even, or Steve Bannon, or I think a lot of people seem familiar. They seem a little bit more in the shadows. Do you have some sense of them more from working in the White House and around the Trump administration?
You know, I really don't. I'll like catch glimpses of them sometimes. Like, you know, they walked past me yesterday in the West Wing, but like, I know it's not like they're people who you stop and chat with, or me anyway. I don't know about other reporters. It's not like I'm going to text one of them to get some background on what went down in a meeting. Do you know what I mean? So they're very different than most White House officials just in that respect. But they also just seem sort of far away. They're kind of untouchable in a way. And it's not, I have less of a sense of who they are as people than I do, I think, of most other White House officials.
Do you get a sense of that there are people in the White House who genuinely think Trump is a great leader and have great respect for him and see this as deep down as something other than a shit show?
No.
No, well,
I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't really gotten that vibe. I mean, sometimes I'll talk to someone and I'll think like, wow, they really drank the Kool-Aid this week. You know, they sound like a mini Trump. Or they're arguing something to me that has no basis in reality in a very Trumpian way. But broadly speaking, I think, you know, most people are here for very self-serving reasons. I think you only really work for Donald Trump for very self-serving reasons, whether that was previously or now in the White House. And certainly, you know, I never get the impression that anyone thinks that he's some kind of genius.
My last question for you about your story this week, which is, did you get a sense when you were talking to Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, did you get a sense that they were at all aware of, I think what you mentioned, some of the errors that they had made during the primary? Or do you get the sense that they're still sort of, they've actually convinced themselves that Trump has changed and they handled things well during that time when they were kissing up to him?
They are completely convinced that they've done nothing wrong. I mean, unless they were just lying to me about how they feel, which is possible, they seem very convinced that they handled everything fine and that there was nothing unusual or unsavory about what they did during the primary. They're very defensive about it, too. You know, they'll name other reporters now and in history who they think have behaved similarly. So, no, I don't think so at all. But, you know, the strangest thing about that piece was that the White House spent so much time engaging on it. Meanwhile, you know, what they're arguing pretty much the whole time is that this is not something that we care about. We don't pay attention to them. And the president doesn't even really think about these people that he tweets about. But, you know, they spent considerable time talking to me about the two of them. And, you know, when they could have been, like, I don't know, figuring out what's in the healthcare bill.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, but not surprising. Olivia Nuzzi is the Washington correspondent for New York Magazine. She has the cover story and the current issue on newsstands now. Olivia, thank you for taking time out of your White House day to join us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Sorry for all the noise.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Audrey Dilling with help today from nobody because Olivia joined us by phone from outside the White House. Our theme music was composed by Doug Chase. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to let me know your thoughts, please email me at ask@slate.com. That's ask@slate.com. And one more thing. If you're looking for more great podcasts from Slate, check out the Double X Gab Fest. It's a podcast that covers feminism, gender, sexuality, health, politics, Beyonce, and other issues relevant to women and feminism. It's hosted by Hannah Rosen from Invisibilia, New York Magazine's Noreen Malone, and Slate's own June Thomas, the great June Thomas. I recommend it highly. Find the Double X Gab Fest at slate.com/XX or wherever you get your podcasts.